Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy-O's?
Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in again to the show. I am trying to get these out on a fairly regular basis, and wow, I can't believe today's the 17th episode. It only took me like almost 2 years to get here, but I will pick up the pace from now on. And thanks so much for all your comments. I've been getting some great reviews, great comments. I pretty much get emails every day about the podcast. You know, to answer a few of your questions and comments, I get suggestions for people to interview, but I only interview people I know as a general rule, and I don't like to do Skype and things like that. So that's why I like waiting around sometimes. I have to do it in person. It's just more intimate. I think it creates a better quality podcast for your listening. But thanks again for your comments. Either way, I love hearing from everybody.
Dance me to your beauty with a burning violin. Dance me through the panic till I'm gathered safely in. Lift me like an olive branch and be my home. Dance me to the end of love.
All right, well, let's talk about today's guest. My guest today is singer, songwriter, and guitarist, and my friend, Madeline Peru. Known for her sultry, retro vocal style and phrasing, Madeline is an internationally known jazz and blues artist, having headlined some of the biggest jazz festivals in the world, from Europe to Japan and all points in between. And as a part-time member of her band, myself, on and off for maybe a period of 3 or 4 years, maybe more, I got to play at a lot of them, you know, Hollywood Bowl, Hammersmith Apollo, London, Beacon, New York City, North Sea Jazz Festival, a bunch of great times with Madeline. As you'll hear on this episode, she's lots of fun, lots of laughs. And her biography is well known online. You can find it, but she's got an interesting story. She's from the U.S., but she was kind of raised in Paris and lived on the street and worked as a street musician. And really cool story. You'll hear about it. We'll talk about all that stuff. She's got a really unique guitar style that I like, too. We'll talk about some of the ways she approaches her style and voicings and things like that. All right, well, on a nice hot day in August, I took the subway over to Madeline's apartment in Brooklyn. We sat for a minute and chatted and then just turned the mics on and let her roll. So I hope you enjoy this one. You'll hear the windows were open, and she lives across the street from a park, so you'll hear like kids playing, but it's not too intrusive, hopefully. And all right, follow me upstairs. I'm walking up to Maddie's apartment in Brooklyn. She picks up her Martin guitar. Spend a minute getting a tone happening, and then we try to figure out what to play, and eventually we figure it out. Hope you enjoy. Is that too loud?
It's beautiful.
Well, you want to just play something? Just
yeah.
Talk first.
I mean, okay. What should we play, man?
Oh man, it's been so long. I don't know.
Well, I don't know, man. I would love to do something with you that we used to play. There were a bunch of great songs that we used to.
I know there were
that
so
was so
many
fun together, and I really don't.
Something simple, and then maybe after we'll do, because I don't remember a lot of. I should have brought a set list. Yeah, Don't Cry Baby.
We could do that.
Just a,
you want to do that?
Yeah.
All right. Honey, please don't cry. Listen to me. There's no reason why we shouldn't agree. If I hurt your feelings, I apologize. You're the hearts again. Don't you know I didn't mean to make you feel blue? Honestly, I'll try to never ever do that again. Won't you forgive him? Won't you forget? Do as I ask you to. I'll never let you regret. But if you'd only start anew, well, you sorry. Yes, I'm sorry, so don't cry, baby. There's no one else around but you. Yes, don't cry, baby. There ain't nobody else but you.
Yeah, Madeline. It was sort of coming back to me towards the end there. Last
me too.
All right. Well, I'm sitting in Brooklyn, New York with my friend Madeline Peru. Or as my friend Nori calls it, Brooklyn. Yeah, beautiful place.
Thank you. Yeah, we're in deep Brooklyn here. For deep. Those that like that term.
Why is it deep Brooklyn?
It's like further than Manhattanites have ever gone, mostly.
It's further than this would-be Manhattanite has ever gone, I think.
Yeah, probably. We're deep on the south side of it rather than the east. Like, we're not out towards Bed-Stuy or Flatbush were south of everything towards the Verrazanos, Sunset Park. And we can see the Statue of Liberty from here.
It's a beautiful view out of that kitchen window.
You can see that Statue of Liberty every, you know, morning and night. At night, it's all lit up. And it's kind of powerful.
Powerful. Well, listen, I know you've done, like, real legit interviews for NPR and, like, you know, notable music journalists, and I'm flattered that you would, you know, entertain my little hobby here and have me.
It's a beautiful thing that you're doing. We were just talking before we started that the idea of the podcast in and of itself is kind of like going back to radio and also the original form of storytelling, right?
Right.
So that your mind fills in all the blanks, that you're not being bombarded with pictures or noise.
Well, you make up your own pictures.
Yeah. What was the other thing we were saying about it? I can't remember now.
I don't know. It was 5 minutes ago. I don't know.
something about... Yeah, I lost it. Sorry. Cut!
I'll just give the listeners some background. I mean, I just had John Harrington on the podcast. John's been your longtime guitar player for many years.
It's added up. Yeah, we just hit the 10-year mark now.
It's got to be 10 years.
You know, it's not the only guitar player. You were part of those 10 years, too.
I was, because I went through an email last night to see if I could... I'm going to cheat here and confess that I tried to find some charts in case we played something. I found the original email you sent me. You were in Japan, and it was 2007.
Okay.
And
wow.
That's 10 years.
Wow.
So we've known each other a while, and we've, you know, I got to say, this is no bullshit. Like, some of my most memorable musical times on stage have been with you and that band.
No.
I'm serious. It's the, you know, because... The thing that I liked about playing with you was just the space. I really learned a lot about space. You know, I would innately just go for something, and I would have, you know, Jim Beard or Ted Baker or somebody look at me and go, "Whoa, no, just lay out there." They wouldn't say it, but they would say it with their eye. And I started learning about space, and you too. You know, I learned a lot on that gig, and it was just so refreshing to, like, get off stage and be like, "Wow, I just remember." Many nights I really did like it. I'm not just saying it. So,
aww, well, that's so sweet to hear that. I mean, obviously it's not my doing, but it's just the whole dynamic of us all together. And
no, you had a lot of good lessons.
Knowing how to work with space. Sometimes there's too much space in my head.
They make things for that.
Pills.
But we went a lot of places together, man. I was thinking about, you know, sometimes I'll think, oh yeah, I've been here before. Oh yeah, with Madeline.
Really?
Oh yeah, cool. Maddie. Yeah, we were here. Yeah, it was a lot. I mean, it seems like we were in France for like 2 months one time.
Well, that's because you didn't like it there.
Well, let's say
it was probably only a week.
Now you've just pissed off the two people in France that listen to this.
Well, they don't know why, so it's okay.
Let's just say it's failed to resonate with my ancestral. It never really.
I think it's fascinating that there were things that you didn't like in France that really were important to you. That probably does come from your ancestral.
Yeah, it failed to resonate on
culture.
Some deep ancestral level.
Maybe it resonated on. Maybe it was the contrary that it resonated because. Your people left that place.
Yeah, well, we were probably like the provincial, you know, farmers and poor people there that got kicked out. So maybe
yeah,
that's
you were sick of the nonsense, which is, and there is something to be said for the tragedy of the sort of old world culture that includes imperialism and, you know, royalty, monarchism, and, you know, it's still there.
Yeah.
And America's really still has that spirit of, like, of the original with the that comes from that original idea. We found it on some. There's some great things that we did when we started this country. There's a lot of horrible things that we did, but that's not one of them. You know.
Man, we're 10 minutes in, and this is already deeper than any episode. No, that's cool.
Well, it's off. It's not on a musical topic. You can totally edit anything out that I said.
Anything. I could lie to you. I don't edit at all.
But yeah, so songs that we do together and the times that we've had on the road together. Yeah.
I remember playing at the Beacon with you and, you know, coming up to New York all the time to rehearse, and everybody in the band was New York except me. I remember I would lose my temper, Barack. And Barack would be like, "You should move to New York, Shane, and in 6 months you're going to be like us and real hard edge." And I go, "Man, I would never move here. Like set up like a giant pain in the ass. I love visiting. I would never live here. Now here it is. Uh-huh. I'm here." You know, and I do love it, I got to say.
Yeah.
I really do. I like it a lot. But.
Well, maybe New York has... I hate it. But, I mean, I live here. So I hate it in the way that somebody hates it when they live there. I don't hate it from afar. I hate it up close.
Well, if I like having the balance between New Orleans and, you know, I crave the... It's sort of an expensive migratory pattern to keep up, but... I like it. I like New Orleans, New York balance. It seems like you've been over to my house and hung out, and you like New Orleans too, right?
It's wonderful, yeah.
And you have some people there. I think of it as very different. Too.
Yeah, my name is from New Orleans. That's where my last name comes from, where my dad's family comes from. I have a lot of cousins down there that I don't know, and there are some that I do know. I think you were there that night that we played the blues club.
House
What's it
blues.
Called? The House of Blues. Thank you.
Yep.
In New Orleans. And when we walked in to do the sound check, the guy that runs the club down there came up to me and said, "Hello, you're my cousin."
Give me a kiss.
Well.
But you've always had that was one of the things I wanted to discuss before we get into your whole background. Like, you've always had an affinity from New Orleans and for New Orleans, and I don't know where that came from. Was it the music, or was it just, you just like...
Well, yeah, I think it's the music first, because it's what I got from my dad, you know.
And your dad was from New Orleans.
My dad was born and raised in New Orleans, yeah. So I got more from him. I got... The music that he listened to over and over again had this variety to it, and this sort of, I think this sort of sensitivity to sort of what's the way it's a special feel behind music that has, for lack of a better word, more soul than a lot of other music that might be in the same genre. Like, it's, there's something, and I'm not just talking about New Orleans musicians, though it's true, but I'm also talking about sort of that cultural thing that's in New Orleans in the music, that it's just, there's it's warm. It's always felt to me like it's very, very warm hearted, and more so than anywhere else. And I think my dad was naturally interested in that when he chose what to listen to around the house. And man, did he put on records. He was like a friend of mine, and the only thing he could play was a record player, but he played it all the time, you know.
Like, what did he play? You remember any?
Yeah. Hank Williams Sr., Buddy Holly, Fats Domino, you know, Louis Armstrong. It was pretty eclectic.
Those are four good
Randy
ones right
Newman.
There. Yeah.
Yeah, it was always good shit. he, I don't think there's anything that, I mean, I don't know. A friend of mine doesn't like Jim Croce, but he listened to a lot of Jim Croce too. And I loved Jim Croce because of him.
You know, you and I are probably about the same age, and I was wondering, I never asked you about this, but any, like, mainstream pop stuff, because I know it was on the radio we were growing up. I mean, did you ever listen to any of that? Were you ever, like, a fan of some boy band or something like that, or was it always...
Well, you know, you just mentioned Tears for Fears.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked them.
Yeah, they're great.
And U2, and... but, you know... Most of the time, my memories of the radio, and Michael Jackson, of course, but not all of Michael Jackson at the time, because I didn't hear it for the music. I mostly heard, like, this culture that was, like, Reebok sneakers and hairspray and, you know, that I did. It was a noisy culture to me.
Ferris wheels and...
Yeah, exactly.
Fire engine trucks. No.
Well,
that's what he had when the police raided his place. They followed him out, and he was riding in his fire truck.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway.
Well, I'm thinking of, like, this Brooklyn, basically where we are now, like, the culture that was here in the 80s was on the radio, was sort of in sync with the radio at,
like,
that
Run
time.
Run DMC and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was good shit.
Yeah.
I have to say, that was good shit. And the Beastie Boys was a big pride of ours, you know, out here in Brooklyn. And that was fun. Some of that stuff, I don't know, it sounds a lot better now than it did at the time to me. Some of the some of the 80s pop was better than I thought it was. I would try to listen to the radio and try to find out what other kids in school were on about and where they get these ideas from. And I didn't get a lot out of it. You know, so I retreated into the stuff that my dad had at home, records and whatever tapes people would make for me. I had a lot of mixtapes when I was growing up. That was my favorite thing. Make me another tape.
Yeah, tapes.
You can cry a million tears. You can wait.
So a lot of people think of you as, like, French American, you know, which I guess you are because you lived there for a long time. But you were born in Georgia, Athens, Georgia.
Yeah.
Which is a cool place.
Yeah, I didn't really get to know it until later. We went back on my own. But
yeah,
as a kid.
Yeah, that's a great town, man. But you're really, I think of you as more of a New Yorker. You've been in New York most of your life, right?
Yeah, I am a New Yorker in a way. I feel I'm looking at you with a little bit of shame when I say that, in the sense that, you know, I look around and sometimes it's the city is tough. You know, big cities are so tough. And I embraced that toughness at first. And I was like, I wanted to be so tough, man, that I was just mean when I was like 11. You know, like a mean 11-year-old is just such a funny, weird thing. This is not going to last, you know, but at the time, it seemed like a really good idea. This is how I need to be. I need to be like this. And it wasn't until I left New York City that I learned that a lot of the ideas I had about the world were wrong. So some of that, I think, comes from New York itself, the way that New York treats you and sets things apart. Some things are always out of reach here because it's always, there's so much money driving our experiences of the city that it's sort of like, well, this sucks, you know, I got to sit on this train for hours every day, or I have to, you know. But now it's just as tough, but now I've come back to it with the attitude of, I feel at home here, and there's a lot of stuff that I believe in here, and of course people that I love that are here, which obviously is the key to any place, right?
Right.
You know, I didn't choose to stay over in France and, like, I'm gonna adopt France. That didn't work for me, you know, and I can't deny that it was amazing to be there, which at the time I didn't. When I first moved there, I was about 12, and I was like, "This is a very bad.
But you were thrown into it. Like, your mom just, you basically went, like, you didn't really know anybody there, right? Were you?
No.
Could you speak French when you went there?
No.
Wow, that must have been really hard.
Well, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
But, you know, in retrospect, it's like,
it forces you to
changed
grow, right?
My life. Yeah. It changed my life in a way that nothing else could, you know. Not just to learn a new language, but to just have this different perspective on the world. And it's funny, I just moved into this apartment in Sunset Park a few months back, and I have this view facing west, right? Which is, from here, it's the Statue of Liberty, and then New Jersey, and then obviously what comes after that, and the rest of the United States. And mm-hmm. When I lived in Paris with the street band I lived with, we were on the Seine on the boat. And it was always amazing from that perspective to look west and see the sunset and go, that's where America is. America's that way. Like that new world stuff, these big dreams of
go west, young man.
Creating your own life and everything. And look at all of the horrible things that happen when you do that. You say, yeah, we're going to start something brand new that's never been done before. Well, you end up destroying a whole lot of old things, like people that lived here, for example, before the Europeans got here, or destroying maybe the structures that you came from and losing them and having to start over and say, well, what is my culture really? What is, you know, where are we? Obviously, like I said before, there's a lot of wonderful things, I think, that are here. And New York is kind of, to me, it feels like the center of mm-hmm. where that all mm-hmm. began.
Yeah, you can feel an energy here. I said that on another podcast. I get so much done here in a week. And I go back to New Orleans and I think, oh, man, how could I leave here? But then I don't get anything accomplished. You know?
Really?
Something about the energy. I think it's a...
That's good. You're inspiring me to get stuff done. I think it's more about you than it is necessarily about...
Maybe.
Like, time and place have to go together, you know?
I guess so. I guess it's all... Everybody's got their own story. How is your mom, actually? I meant to ask.
She's well. Good. Thank you. Yeah. I just saw her a lot,
She's
actually.
Great. Yeah, tell her hi.
Okay.
Remember I tripped in Sweden backstage and she broke my fall for me.
Oh, she did? Yeah. She really liked your jokes.
Oh, God. That's why.
Yeah. Have you shared a lot of your joke sort of self on the podcast yet?
Sometimes. Okay. You know, it's not really about me, but I probably don't know any more new ones since then. You know.
There you go.
So listeners get a little background. I'm sure most people know that. You've probably said all this stuff 100 times, but when you were in France, in Paris, you became a street musician.
Right.
And that was like your formative thing. You don't have to go into the whole story about it, but how was that starting out? I mean, it must have been, was it exciting at first, or were you scared, or you were with a group of people, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. I was terrified by myself. Well, I mean... What was happening was I thought that I would hang out where these street musicians were hanging out and watch them to learn guitar because, you know, we didn't have money for lessons. And also, even if you do have money for lessons, you don't really... There was nobody in my family or in my life that really would say, oh, you should study with this or you should do that. Like, I was just like, I just want to get past the first 3 chords and I want to pick something up, and there's these musicians hanging out, these street musicians, all in this one cafe, which is itself kind of like an amazing situation that I stumbled on, and that's like a long story. But so first I was just hanging out, and then it was terrifying when I did my first terrace by myself. Well, that's a very strong memory when I was, you know, sitting around picking guitar outside this cafe, and a friend of mine sat there and he said, you know what, you're really good. I remember looking at him, he's usually half drunk by early afternoon anyway, and I was just like, okay, thanks. And then he's like, no, really, I mean, you're really good. He said, Why don't you, have you played a terrace yet? Have you, you know, playing a terrace for people that are not street musicians means, and a terrace in this case in Europe is a place where people are seated outside in a cafe all the tables are set up and, you know, waiter is serving you on your on the outdoor terrace of the restaurant. And playing a terrace is just walking up to a bunch of tables and sort of imposing yourself by starting to play music. And it's enough of a tradition that certain neighborhoods in Paris, especially the quiet ones with the smaller streets and less traffic, that you expect that that's going to happen. Now, if you sit down to have a meal at a restaurant outside when on a nice summer day, somebody comes along and does a show, a clown starts a show or a musician starts playing, and you decide whether you like it or not, right? But so I've been watching these guys play these terraces, and I went up there with my guitar. I said, I got to have three songs, and I got to do it by myself. And he said, look, if you play it, I'll pass the hat for you. Because I was like, there's no way I'm going to pass the hat with these people. It's too in your, it's very in your face. You know, it's a very different relationship with an audience when you know you're going to have to walk up to their table, look them all in the eyes, see who they are, see whether or not they like the fact that first you imposed on them, but not only that, and you might have interrupted them, but maybe you gave them some pleasure, and then say, how much do you think this was worth? Which is, you know, more than zero, hopefully, is what you're, where you start, right? I think that really affects you as a performer when you, if you have to do that. And it's not begging. It can be, it can feel like begging. It's up to the person passing the hat whether or not it's begging. You can pass the hat and be begging in your demeanor, in your attitude, or you can walk up and say, did you like the music? Would you like to give us something for it?
Yeah.
And be focused on, you know, this is an exchange. This is not begging. But nobody's forcing you to do anything. And I hope you liked the music. If you didn't like it, I'll leave you alone, you know?
Yeah.
And, whew, man, I was so, like, shaking so much during and after that whole thing. But we got 50 francs, and so we were happy about that. And I was like, oh, if I could make 50 francs... Let me think about this for a second. I think I should try this again sometime, but I got to get up the courage to do it, you know.
Tandis qu'au-delà des mers, là-bas sous le ciel clair, il existe une cité au séjour enchanté. Et sous les grands arbres noirs, chaque soir, vers le s'en va tout mon espoir. J'ai deux amours.
That was a strong memory for me. And
man, those must have been some hard lessons. But that's the way you get your stuff together, man. It's being thrown into the fire like that, huh? On the street. And it's teaching you about business, how to handle an audience, how to... read an audience. I mean, that's like,
yeah, there in that aspect, the fact that everybody's so close to you and you're drawing, there's the other thing we call a pitch, which is where you just set up on a corner and you hope to draw a crowd, and that's a lot harder than having the captive audience of a terrace, right? So you get to that point, and I got to the point where I was like, I got to learn how to get a pitch and do it by myself. And that's hard, man. That is the hardest one. And yet a good pitch has the most amazing energy, I think, really, for anybody. A musician would love it, you know, and everybody else would love it too. And you're all kind of together on the same plane, and it's very exciting. So, yeah. If you can create that atmosphere in a concert hall or an arena or whatever size places you play nowadays, I mean, that's the key, I think, just remembering, like, okay, how do you get in touch? Because it's funny how you're walking down the street and you decide to stop and have a really great experience. That happens to me sometimes. I think just the other day, what was it? It was so great. Oh, God. Let me think for a second. Oh, yeah. It was yesterday. I took my brother for a walk in Central Park. And, you know, those beautiful sort of underground passerelles or whatever they're called, where the acoustics are just, you know, perfect. And there was a five-piece acoustic vocal group. And we just stopped and stayed in there. And yeah, man, they were really, really working. And it sounded fantastic. And that's exactly the kind of beautiful energy where people are walking by and they're not expecting anything. And then this wonderful thing happens. Yeah, I'll give you some money for that, you know. And it's also on the same plane financially as like eating food. I mean, have you ever thought about the fact that a really good restaurant experience, you don't prepay for it. For some reason, you pay at the end. And I think the reason is that there's a more pure feeling of genuine exchange, you know? So,
I never thought about that.
I like that. Although, you probably... Sometimes you'll find you get more than you expected, and sometimes you find you get less than you expected. So it's a little bit more difficult to be part
of
this.
There's no regulation going on with it.
Yeah. The world is not secure. And most of the people at that time that we were on there was a whole lifestyle involved, you know. The good thing about it is I really could just play music all the time.
All right, I'm gonna do a complete 180 and take us back to what, like a more technical kind of question, but just for the guitar players that are listening to this, what guitar were you playing back then when you were busking? What was your first guitar you had?
Well, the first guitar I ever had was just a Yamaha Dreadnought guitar. It was okay. It was decent. And then I think somebody stole it. And I was on the street, so I really had to figure out a way to get another guitar. And that took a while. And I have found that it's a really personal thing, even though it's fun to have like several different kinds of instruments and guitars and stuff. It can really affect you if you have sort of a connection to one instrument more than the others. And that didn't happen for me for a long time. It wasn't until I made my first record, and then I was lucky enough to be in the studio with the drummer from The Attractions, Pete Thomas, one day, on a recording that was never finished, actually, for various label reasons. What happened was, in the green room, he had just picked up this guitar at a pawn shop, and it was just sitting in there, and it was perfect for me. I just like, you know, lit up when I saw this guitar, and it was just really small. It's a Martin 017
48 47
it turned out I believe it's 1943.
Oh,
43. Yeah, because one thing is for sure, it's during the Second World War. And because of that, metal rationing was going on, and they wouldn't put any steel in it, so no truss rod.
Yeah.
And there were other things like the frets and stuff that were, I think, brass or copper. I'm not really sure, but I had it to get it all get the neck all redone and everything. Well, what happened was my mentor who signed me to the record company, Yves Beauvais, was there at the session, and he saw me playing this guitar, and he was like, "Well, you want me to ask Pete if I pay him more for the session and then let you have the guitar?" And I was like, "Well, I don't want to piss him off, you know."
Yeah.
And then so he said, "Well, it doesn't hurt to ask, you know." I said, "Okay." And so he asked him, and he said, "Oh, my wife will be so happy. I didn't bring home another." You know, he said, "I have tons of these things that I buy in these
shops."
That's
the little mahogany one. Yeah, I have. Yeah. You know, I have a 53 or 52, just like it. I mean,
really?
Obviously, it's 10 years younger, but yeah.
I never saw that.
I sent you a picture once. I found it in a pawn shop. Yeah. But it's a great guitar, man. The mahogany is old, and it just sounds so good.
It dries up.
I like that, yours. I've played yours.
Old
before.
Mahogany guitar, yeah. Like, that wood gets so dry that it gets so resonant, and you can just tell. And also, it's so light.
Mm-hmm.
There's something so magical about that. And also, because it's small, it just feels way more natural than a dreadnought guitar. I don't know why everybody starts on a dreadnought. It's not, to me, dreadnoughts are really hard to play. They're usually, you know, kind of unbalanced.
Yeah.
So just playing these open chords like that are, it's not great at the beginning, and it's hard to play them in tune because you're down in the first position.
Right.
And so everything's kind of out of tune all the time. And it just, when you finally get like a small bodied guitar coming from those kinds of things, you go, if you're into acoustic guitars, I think it's just, for me, it was just like, oh, whoa, wait a minute, I could actually sound good.
Yeah, that's a great guitar. I mean, the one you have now is, you were telling me you had to since retire that guitar that you had forever, and now you have...
Another Martin.
Another Martin.
Yeah, a new one. This is an 018. Sorry, 0018. 0018.
Yeah.
But relatively small, and also very, you know, same thing, very balanced sound. And it's also got the a wider neck, you know, the sort of vintage style neck.
Yeah.
So it's a comfortable, for me, it's more comfortable to have that space. And
yeah, because you have an interesting style. I mean, I want to talk about who were some of your guitar influences. Because, you know, you do all these kind of voicings, like these kind of three note.
Yeah.
Those things. And where did you learn that stuff from? I mean, who were some of your influences on guitar?
Well, we in this first street band that we were in, the leader, the musical director was this Dutch guitarist who was going to the Jazz Conservatory over in Holland, in Hilversum, Holland, and he would put together these arrangements because we didn't play with a bass. We played with a washtub bass as a percussive instrument and no drums. And he would put together these arrangements where there would be a rhythm guitar player playing those kinds of chords with the bass note and then sort of the third and then the tension up top. Just those things to move around. Any almost became sort of like a, for me, like an idiot's guide to difficult harmony, like to be able to say that what sounds, it starts to sound, you know, they're so beautiful
mm-hmm.
on the guitar. It's actually easy to play those voicings that are so hard on, you know, like on a piano, to visualize on a piano these sort of...
Yeah, the wide gap, the interval gap.
Yeah.
It's like Freddie Green or something, you know.
It is. It's totally influenced by Freddie Green and Count Basie style rhythm playing. It's minimalist. And when I saw this rhythm guitar player doing that with these guys, and, you know, he and I would practice together because we were the two newbies in the band. And... I remember when I said, you know, I can't practice the songs when you're not here, and I'm really upset about that. And he's like, you can play this stuff. I was like, no, you don't understand. And he's like, no, you don't understand, you know.
Mm.
And it was a good thing that he just said, man, just start by learn to play a blues in these two type of shapes. And boy, was that a revelation that, you know, that you don't need a lot of notes. And I'm still getting that revelation now because, like, recently I worked with an orchestra and we were trying to put together arrangements. There's not a lot of notes. The less notes involved, the better.
Less is more.
Yeah.
Especially when you have a piano player. Like, when I was playing with you, you know, I wouldn't play with that your tune, you know, that you did. It's like... hardly anything, you know, but it doesn't need any more. It's just enough.
But like, it's kind of powerful in that
very
sense.
Powerful.
If you get it to sound really clear. Yeah.
If you add all these extensions, you know, just it gets too dense and it's more of a statement, I think, with just the...
Yeah, kind of like the way a podcast gives you freedom. We've gone full circle.
I want to hear where this is going, yeah.
The way a podcast gives you that space in your mind to imagine things and to visualize, I don't know, to visualize you playing guitar while you're,
yeah,
you know, and to visualize this, a story as you hear voices. I think it's kind of similar in music. You give yourself space, you know,
yeah.
And you, it gives you more room gives the audience room is what I mean. The listener gets room to be more involved in it in
right.
a way.
Engaged, yeah.
Every night he'd come to me, I'd cook for him, I'd pour his tea. I was in my 30s then, I'd made some money, lived with men. He'd lay us down.
I'll just talk for a few more minutes if that's all right.
I always remembered right before you stopped touring with me that that there was a period when we were really like I was really really enjoying where we were going with it, you and I.
Except for I remember playing I Hear Music, and that one, Jim Beard is playing the solo before me. You know, and I have to follow him. And I told him, man, I hate having to play after you every night, Jim. You know, can we flip the order or something? And he's like, what? You know, he always had the ear. And he goes, you know what he told me? He goes, now you know how I felt after I had to play after Michael Brecker. And I'm thinking, okay. But I remember you telling me.
That's what he said.
Yeah. And I remember we were somewhere like having a beer and you're like, man, everything's great, but dude, that solo you're playing is not swinging.
Oh, well.
But you know what? You were exactly right.
You're focusing on the one thing that didn't, there was only one
thing.
No,
but I think about that. I mean, now I can play Rhythm Changes because I shedded it, but.
Actually, that song I think is even more tricky.
Because it goes to a two and a five.
It's not, yeah, they're not just Rhythm Changes. There are extra bars.
Yeah.
I mean, anytime I see somebody's recorded that song, I'm like, oh my God, let me find out how they decided to do it, because it doesn't really feel very natural the way that the song was written, but
no, it's
some
weird.
Of it doesn't, you know. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's almost.
It's got the weird.
Yeah, and we were trying to do it faster every night, which was never easy. Oh yeah, that was our arrangement.
Yeah, but
it was in B flat, right? So it was,
mm-hmm.
Mighty fine music, murmur of the morning breeze up there, rattle of the milkman on the stair, as my favorite melody. You, my angel, phoning me.
Different.
Sorry, I can't remember. I hear music, mighty fine music, and anytime I think my world is wrong, get up out of bed and sing this song. Now, I hear music, a mighty fine music, and you die. ba do ba do ba da mo ba do ba da mo ba do ba da ba ba.
Yeah. 10 years later,
wow.
It still sucks. No, I didn't know the
well,
bridge.
I certainly...
That's a different bridge, right? Isn't it?
There's my...
Talking about space, your producer, I don't know if you're working with him anymore, and I can... We don't have to talk about it, or I can take it out. But Larry Klein...
I'm about to work with him,
okay.
Actually. Yeah.
You know, your records was the first one, Half the Perfect World.
Mm-hmm. Careless Love.
Careless
was
Love was your first
made,
one.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Larry Klein has a way of, and for those of you that don't know, Larry Klein's a phenomenal bass player. He played with Freddie Hubbard. He was married to Joni Mitchell. He played with Joni Mitchell. He's done a ton of stuff, but he's primarily a producer now. But the way he captures your voice, whatever his mic choices are, and, you know, his use of space, and I know you have a lot to do with it too, but, you know,
no,
to me, those
I wouldn't
records
say that.
Are gorgeous, man. They're really
yeah.
beautiful records.
Yeah, and of course, Helik Hadar was his engineer. Yeah, the sound of those records kind of still blows me away, and I really don't know how they do it.
Is
so.
There a specific... It's always the same microphone, though? It's got to be the same mic on your voice.
Well, they're standard...
Like a Neumann 67,
yeah.
some old beautiful German mic or something.
Yeah, that's what most... It might be an 87, but it's what most people know to use. It's not really a... I think that there were some serious pre's involved that I don't know anything about. The stuff that goes between the microphone
yeah,
and...
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, I know yeah, yeah. about preamps and things, but for the purpose of this, I mean, just the general tone of your voice is... You don't really need much. You know, you could sing into this... Sure, 58 right here, and it would sound great, you know.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I was just wondering if there's anything, because those recordings are beautiful. And
yeah, I agree. I think that there's a serious statement involved in that. I really enjoy that about Larry, among so many other things. You know, I spend so much time thinking about other things rather than learning how he does stuff in the studio, and I'm gonna try to catch up in the future. You know, most of the time I'm more worried about songwriting and arrangements. And
well, let's talk about songwriting for a minute. I want to ask you about co-writing. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about your own process too, but I know you were, I think you told me one time you wrote some songs with Bill Wyman.
Oh, yeah.
What was that like?
Oh, my God. It was just so fun. You know... Bill Wyman hasn't got, it's the same thing, I think. Well, it might not be true for everybody, but there are some people that are just so genuinely humble that there's nothing between, if you're so lucky to be in the same room with them, there's really nothing between you besides just being a human being. Bill is definitely like that. Larry's definitely like that.
Walter Becker, you wrote a lot of stuff with him, right?
Not maybe, but I think it's two songs, and that's really because of Larry. I wasn't in the room with Walter as much. I mean, I did spend some time with him, and of course he's obviously, yeah, he's also just a really human soul. You can kind of tell that from his music. You can't always tell that with some people on the artist. I don't know. The thing about Bill, well, where should we go next?
No, whatever you want. I mean, that's fine. You talk about Bill, yeah. The process, or what was it like to
well,
work with him?
Well, the thing that strikes me is that he had a lot of these ideas that were sort of half finished. And that blew my mind right away because, first of all, that's all I have is half finished ideas most of the time. Or not finished, not even close to half finished. And I think he was willing to just open up, and he handed me, like, maybe the first day I came in and sat down and I was explaining, you know, I really love to just write. And we were talking, he was telling me, explaining to me a lot of the dynamic of being the bad boys back in the early days of the Stones and why they became that. And how they became that. And you were there when I first met Bill Wyman, weren't you?
I don't remember.
You don't remember that? We were at the Nice Jazz Festival.
Yeah.
Backstage, we had just played, and it was getting dark, or it was just about dark. And somebody came up to me and said, "Hey, I'd like to meet you. My name is Phil Rolling Stones." And I couldn't hear him properly. And I thought he said he worked with the bass player of the Rolling Stones. What he actually had said is, "I was the bass player of the Rolling Stones." I didn't get it. And I said, "Sorry, I have to go talk to somebody. I'll be right back."
That's great.
It was terrible. I don't think it's that awesome. But you were there backstage. He patiently waited while I did an interview. And I came back. And then it started to sink in as he talked about people that he knows. And I'm here for, he was there to see B.B. King and blah, blah, blah. And then you came up. We were going to take a picture together. And you came back and everybody suddenly like ran in like, "Let me get a picture with this guy." And you came up to him and you said, "I know who you are." That's what you said to him. And we took a picture. We took pictures together with him. You don't remember any of that?
No.
You got palatial mansions. I got a rented flat. You got Persian kittens. I got tabby cat. You got art collections. I got comic books. You use plastic surgery. Stay the way I look. Your travel project. I stand by overnight. You romance with chandeliers.
I had a friend who used to play in this band called Nickel Creek, this bluegrass band, and he was playing in London somewhere, Apollo or whatever. And after the gig, he's a bass player, and after the gig, the tour manager says, his name's Derek. He goes, "Derek, somebody wants to meet you, you know." And he goes, "Okay, well, I didn't have any guests." He goes, "Well, I'll send it back." So John Paul Jones walks in from Led Zeppelin, right? He's a big bluegrass fan. And he goes up to my friend. My friend Derek is like, he doesn't know what to say. So he puts his hand out. He's like speechless. And he goes, "Hi, I'm John Paul Jones." And Derek just stares at him. And John Paul Jones leans in and he goes, "From Led Zeppelin." Just to make sure he knew. And he's like, "Oh, no, I mean, I know who you are. I didn't know what to say, you know." But anyway, I don't remember. Maybe I remember that. It couldn't have been more than 7 years ago, 6 years ago. Shit, it's might as well be 20 years.
I know, yeah. How does the time fly? But that's why we're young, right? It's the theory of special relativity. The faster you move, the slower time passes. Yeah. I've been hanging out with my mathematician brother for the last couple of days.
Is he really a mathematician?
Yeah, he studies it.
Oh, he studies it. So you can call yourself a mathematician if you just study it.
For the purposes of this conversation, you're a comedian, first of all.
I'm just joking, man. I'm just joking. Anyway, I totally derailed the whole conversation.
Did you?
But why don't we play something?
Let's play something.
You know what's I love hearing you sing is Between the Bars.
Can we
do just a taste?
I'd love to. Yeah.
Man, Elliott Smith or something?
Yes,
but your
Elliott
version
Smith.
Of it is.
Cool. Oh, lovely. That's a great
And I'll try to remember, but I'll just let you play most of it because I don't remember what I used to play on it. It was probably minimal, though.
You're teasing now.
Probably had tremolo on it. Okay.
Okay. Drink up, baby. Stay up all night. Things you could do. You won't, but you might. The potential you'd be, you'll never see. Promises you only make. Drink up with
with me now and forget all about pressure of days. Do what I say and I'll make you okay and drive them away. The images stuck in your head.
Sure. It's so gorgeous, man.
I'll kiss you again between the bars while I'm seeing you there, your hands in the air, waiting to find it because.
Wow, that's beautiful. I always love that, hearing you sing that.
Thank you.
It gives me a goosebumps.
Oh, yeah, good, because it's hot weather up in here.
Have you, you still play that sometimes?
Sure, sure thing, yeah. That's one of the things that has definitely changed over the years is that I've learned that once you do a song and you say I'm going to try and do this and really make it my own, you get stuck with it.
Yeah.
And not in a bad way, but it really is a commitment that, you know, like riding a bicycle, you say I'm going to learn to ride a bicycle, well then now you ride a bicycle for the rest of, you can anyway, and you know obviously sometimes you have to keep playing, but I mean that there's sort of an identity involved in each song that's,
mm-hmm. And people kind of expect to hear it. They want to hear you sing it.
Yeah. Well, there's also the fact that, you know, when there's a great song, you can't just walk away from it. I mean, it's a funny thing, though, that I do feel like as time goes by and you get older or you get wiser or you don't or you change or whatever, that you start to look for different meanings in your life, and you think, I want a song that talks about this, and I want a song that talks about that, and I feel like exploring this and that in the music that you do, and it's almost like a little problem is figuring out where do all these songs go, you know? Where do they go? Where do they end up? Do they belong in the now always? I mean, even like the fact that I started my career doing songs that were mostly all pre-1960, at least, if not older, and then even picking up songs later that are more recent from, and then writing my own songs, I mean, where do they belong in history and in time? Do they always belong in the now? Like Dance Me to the End of Love by Leonard Cohen, you know, I'm sure I've played a show at some point over the last 12 years where I didn't do that song, but it's probably the only once because I can't really think, I can't remember it.
Was that the one that was on the Dockers commercial? Which one was the Dockers commercial?
Oh, you're talking about a song I wrote, actually. Don't Wait Too Long.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What's so funny is that I'll never forget that commercial was then like they did a parody of it on YouTube where it's a gay meeting on a train, two people that are
really?
Gay meeting on a train rather than a straight, they took the same story as this commercial of people seeing each other on trams that are parting in different directions and from San Francisco or something. And then one of them gets off and thinks, oh, the other one's not there. And then the other one also got off. And so on YouTube, there was a same-sex sort of hookup. And I thought that was so cool. And then here we are, like, 12 years later, and, you know, the laws have changed and everything. And it just blows my mind. It makes me so happy.
But somebody did it as a parody?
Yes.
Oh.
With that song.
I'll have to check that out. Yeah.
with I think they were, like, toy people, not real people.
Oh, yeah, On the that's funny.
Yeah.
Didn't you do just a trio thing, you and Barack and John? Secular hymns.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you talk about that real quick?
Oh, it was really fun. Well, it's interesting that you just talked to John Harrington
in your last podcast.
Yeah. It's so cool. And we talked about him earlier, so it'd be nice to just mention that the sort of experience of playing as a trio for me kind of goes back to the experience of being on the street where there's a lot of space and a lot of, you know, being vulnerable in your chair because everything you do is a little bit more more naked, you know. And then there's something very cushy and comfortable about it too, isn't there? Don't you feel that there's something like the trio kind of, everybody seems to get each other's back or something.
Yeah, well, you have a good group of guys.
Well, that's for sure. Yeah,
they listen, and Barack's such a strong player, and the bass player, and your music, I think, lends itself well to, like I was saying, space and trio. So, yeah, it is like a big cushion. It feels, that's what I always liked about playing in that format. So, but now you're even minus a drummer, so you're a real...
We're a real trio, yeah.
Real trio.
Not a singer plus a trio. I met Ron Carter once, and I remember him... He asked me, what's your band? And I said, oh, quartet plus me. And he looked at me. He looked at me like, what? Wait, what? He did a double take, you know, because it's like, oh, you're a singer. It doesn't count, you know. I have to get past that and say, no, this is a quintet. If there are four guys and me.
Exactly.
But anyway, so we're a trio, and it's the kind of nice to embrace that and just try to do more things, you know, like the guys play all kinds of music that we don't play as a trio, but we're all stretched on every level. Like, I'm stretched on my guitar playing, they're singing, we're working on different arrangements. Sometimes John gives me some lead parts to play, and, you know, Barack occasionally has to play percussive stuff on the band. I mean, it's just we're stretched, and so your whole person is involved, you know. Which I hope it continues to be like that when we're not just a trio anymore. You know, I hope I can take the stuff that I learned from the trio and bring it into a bigger setting.
Are there any particular tunes you like off your new record that you think are your favorites? Secular hymns.
Okay, I have to remember what's on there, because we don't have a song called Secular Hymns, unfortunately.
But that's the record, right?
That's the name of the record, yeah. I like our version of Got You On My Mind a lot. You know what I like? If the Sea Was Whiskey. I'm so glad we got to do some really old, you know, country blues songs like that, like that Willie Dixon song. That's always fun. It's so fun.
And I was a diving duck. If the sea was whiskey. And I was a diving duck. I'd dive.
And of course, we've been doing this Secular Hymns record came out, and working on putting it together and then touring it after it came out. This is all during the whole U.S. elections, and we're touring the states and during the caucuses and the various, you know, running up to the election, and then right the day after the election, you know, I was in Atlanta actually with the guys, and just playing the states constantly during all of this, and it just feels like it's all linked, you know, being the small trio and going in and just saying, okay, we're here to soothe you. Like, because everybody needs to be soothed. You feel it in the air in a way that you don't. I feel it now. Maybe I'm, you know, focused on that. But
well, you say you just watched the news, so yeah, they probably so. That's why I don't watch the news. I feel a lot better not watching any sort of media.
But do you feel that that audiences are a little bit like, can you feel the tension that's in the air based on what's been happening that day?
No. Honestly, no. I mean, people are there to have a good time. You know, they pay a lot
right.
of money
it's
to come out.
Always for that reason. That's right.
They don't want to hear any of that bullshit. You know.
Oh no, I'm not saying that we talk about it.
No, I
I'm
know
just
that.
Saying
I'm
that we walk in there and feel.
I don't feel any of that.
A specific kind of like grief or something.
It's like Stevie Wonder comes to Jazz Fest and, you know, people wait in the hot sun all day and then he comes out and he starts talking about, you know, people don't want to hear the politics. It's like, just play your songs, man.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah, every year. Every year he comes and it's just like. But anyway, no, I don't really feel that. I try to just focus on good energy and good positive things and. You know, we've had this discussion before with Katrina and all that stuff, man. It totally changed the way I view any sort of media thing. And with all this recent stuff the past few years, it's been validated. Was I going to ask you one more thing? I don't know. That's a lot.
Just edit it down to the best stuff, okay?
It's all good stuff. You know what I was thinking the other day? You remember we rode in the car with Dave Brubeck? You played Hollywood Bowl. Remember that?
Oh, that's such
that's
a great
really
memory.
Cool, right?
Yeah. And he was old already.
Yeah, he was
and
80
he was,
something.
Like, on his way to Europe that night. He was like just working. He was so nice, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Just, what did he, do you have many memories that I can spark?
Yes,
memories?
McCoy Tyner. We played with him. Remember that? I have videos of that. We were all dancing in the dressing room. And
yeah. I love those videos. That's actually that's one of the great things that you were able to do is to share. You know, another memory I have with you is with the British drummer
Jeremy. I just talked to Jeremy. I see Jeremy sometime. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's playing with King Crimson now. Yeah.
I heard. Yes.
You know what I remember? This is I've told this story before. Remember we were rehearsing? Remember that couple, that old couple that had the rehearsal place and you couldn't touch anything and everything was basically frozen in 1971, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure, I don't know if they're around anymore. They were nice people, but it was a kind of weird place, like, and you couldn't touch anything. But we were rehearsing in there.
What was it called?
I don't remember.
Universal Rehearsal.
It was on 30th or so. But anyway, Jeremy's in there. Madeline just hires this drummer from, he's playing with Sheryl Crow and not Oasis, but Noel Gallagher, the, you know, the, whatever that band is. And remember rehearsal, he'd kick off a song and you were like, hey, could you just do it like maybe just a little slower? And he's like, okay, I'm just telling you that, you know, this is the tempo I got from Darren. This is it. And you're like, okay, but could you maybe just play a little slower? Okay, I will, but I'm just letting you know that this is, you remember that? He kept saying this over and over, like, Jeremy, just play it slower. But he had to have the last right. Oh, okay, I'm just letting you know. Then you were like, okay, listen, I am paying you to like.
No, I didn't.
Yeah,
did I actually
absolutely,
say that?
You were 100% right. I was like, just play it. Like, what do you? Just slow it down, or don't slow down. Tell her you're slow. You know something.
Don't slow it. Tell her you're slowing it down. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Just pretend.
And then,
slower, definitely.
You know, like Barack would wear a suit, and these guys, and I'd show up, and you know, I didn't look bad, but I didn't have a suit. And Jeremy shows up in like basically what he had on the day before, all day, like a black T-shirt, you know, total rock and roll thing. And you were like, hey, listen. I don't care if you guys wear like a suit or anything like that, but could you just wear a shirt with like buttons on it?
Well, but in a way, you know, I liked that he cared about what Darren had told him, and that he like cares enough to get the music right, because obviously that's the first and foremost. But I'm sure that I was in a situation where it was like, we all have to get through all these songs.
And
we don't have time
great.
To talk about that, right?
And you know what he told me? Because I see Jeremy when he comes to New York. He always asks me about you, and he always says, man, that was one of the funnest times. He said, I had so much fun on that tour.
Good.
And musically, it was
I
so good.
I like to think that that's kind of our job, is to have fun. I mean, but you know that. Everybody knows that. It's our job to have fun. But it's a funny thing, right? Well, I'm lucky that I'm having fun with this trio, but it's not always, well, actually, let me think back. I can't think of any times
See, this is the good stuff. I might actually move some of this to the front. Yeah, this is all fun.
Good, yeah, once we warm up, right? Yeah, good stories are, that's what you all you wanted. Oh, that's what I was going to tell you at the very beginning when we were sitting down here. It says, actually, one of my dreams was to make a, when you were talking about what's cool about doing a podcast and why you like it, what your intentions were for it, it reminded me of this idea that I used to think would be so great that I never realized because we tried something and it turned out to be very different, but to get a bunch of people like musicians, but not just musicians, also anybody that's involved in music and even other arts, to just hang out, sort of like a Jim Jarmusch film, you know, sitting around coffee and coffee and pie or something, and try to like
coffee and pie, I love
and try to get in on the conversations that people will have when they're really just brainstorming, like really open-mindedly looking, like there's no instruments around, or there could be instruments around, but you have time in between to just be and to talk to each other and say, hey, what do you think is important about any of this, you know? Mm-hmm. And like really ask some really kind of, you know, maybe deep, but also maybe just freedom, free thinking type questions, and just like let it flow, and then cut all of the good shit together, obviously,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
get
yeah.
somebody to do the hard work. I always thought that would be fascinating because it's not, stories are fascinating, and also this sort of weird space in between everything that we all have, we never get to share that, right?
Right.
You know, there's no way to say, well, obviously, you know how it feels to do that because we're different. So not everything is the same.
It's like you see these old videos with John Lennon and Yoko and everybody sitting around in their New York apartment and, you know, they're
yeah.
talking, all, you know, exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, there's that's a bohemian thing. That's mm-hmm. an aspect of bohemian mm-hmm. life that's mm-hmm. really essential. And it's essential, I think, to city life, too, right? There's so many of us and we're walking around. It's possible in New York City to, well, I tend to isolate, you know. It's good if you can be in a cafe and sit around and talk with other
there's
people.
Definitely some characters in this city, or as Dr. John calls them, characters.
Yeah. That's cool.
Well,
yeah,
I think we've solved
we've solved all
many
the
of the world's issues.
Yeah, well, I can let you go. I feel not like you want to stop.
No, I don't want to take up your time. I have enough, but
you
I
want to tell
edit.
More stories. You can go back to telling a few more stories if you.
No,
it
we
was
have
interesting
some really
how
good
you were
stuff.
Talking about how we had fun on the road, and then I stopped and thought, well, did I ever not have fun on the road? And.
We just acted so immature on the road. We were goofy, and it was fun.
Oh, sure.
And it was, you know what it was? It's like, Hall & Oates, there's like 30 people, 30-something people traveling, and everybody's
yeah.
isolated, and I don't know half the names of the people in the crew and the riggers and all this stuff. Of course, the band is a nucleus,
mm-hmm.
a bunch of guys, and we hang. But with your thing, it was like, it was very small, you know? It was a treat. It was...
Yeah.
It was four people and a tour manager, and it was everybody, you're together all the time, man.
Do you remember that time backstage in London, I think backstage at the Barbican, where Jeremy Stacey was trying to play like...
Oh, I have it on the...
Modern
the,
American...
The
modern
out stuff.
Composing... Yeah, you're just hitting keys.
Didn't
like,
I send you that video with Barack playing the bass
yeah.
note? Yeah, it's so...
Barack jumps in and he like create... It like turns it into a...
With the bow. And there's one where...
Musical
Jeremy's
thing.
Playing... I'm not going to put this on the thing. He's playing like this. He's playing the theme from The Hulk.
Really?
And I focused in, like, and then it comes out, and he's playing the theme for The Hulk, and it sounds great. And I zoom out. It's in a hotel lobby, and I zoom out, and then gradually you see this sign. It says, please do not play me.
Well... Oh, man, no, we've, yeah, but you didn't see the most out stuff was like, to me, the most out it ever got was when and I'm not going to say who, one member of the band went off the wagon and just went all out and just took everything that was available that night in that city and stayed up all night. And I had no idea. Like, that's the way I would do it, so no judgment at all. But in fact, I have done
that's
it.
The way you...
That's, I mean, yeah. I mean, I've done my version of that in other ways too, but the funny part was the next morning. Like, we had to do our normal thing again, and like early in the morning, and get in a van and go to the airport as usual, go to another place. Well, first he's checking out of the hotel, and the hotel, you know, manage representative is saying, "Okay, sir, did you have anything in the minibar?" That's usually the first question they ask, you know. And he said, "All of it. I had all of it." But the manager looks at him funny, like, "I don't think I get," because this is in Brazil, and he looks at him a little funny. He's like, "I'm not sure I understand. Did you have a beer?" He said, "Yes, I had all the beers. I had all of it." He said, "Okay, did you have the soda?" He said, "Yes, I had the soda. I had all of it." And then the hotel manager starts listing every single thing. It took him about 10 minutes to finish asking him did you have the candy bar? What about the mints? Did you have the mints?
He
finally, you know, it was just like, he said he had all of it. Leave him alone. He's just trying to get out of there. And he just keeps saying, I had all of it. And meanwhile, the poor guy is like, really hungover, you know, and really not feeling well. And so after that scene, he got in the car, and then the rest of that morning was horrible. Like, he was sick and unhappy, and to the point where the tour manager said, "You need to go away, right? Get out of here. You need to go separate yourself from the crowd for a while." But those are great memories to me.
I remember,
you know?
A good story now. I think it was in Norway. It was the last show of a tour. And I had a really early lobby call. We all had an early lobby call because I guess I was flying back to New York with you guys. But you were going to L.A., so you had a different time. But it was the last show. And we were staying in like some old hotel, like a converted old house, beautiful place. Hmm. And like 3 o'clock in the morning, all the fire alarms go off.
So
everybody's like, the whole hotel evacuates in the middle of this town, and we're like, man, what the fuck? It's like, I gotta get up in like 2 hours, 3 hours. Everybody's standing out in pajamas, and I see Barack and I see Leslie, and Barack goes, "Madeline." I just saw her going into her hotel room with a cigarette. And the whole hotel, and I didn't see you again for like a year. That was like the last
that's my send off to you.
That's great.
To you poor guys.
Oh my god,
that's terrible. See, Rock said it was me, and
yeah,
he didn't even
I just saw Maddie. She was going out of, she was coming into her room with a cigarette.
Oh, that's terrible. Oh, that is really bad, actually.
Good times. Yeah. See, people think jazz is some badass jazz musicians, man. They're like, you know, they're bad. They're not. They're like, it's worse than rock and roll. All the debauchery.
Well, it's not really. I mean, I told that one story about going all out, drinking the whole mini bar. Of course, I had done that once. For me, when I drank the whole mini bar, it was at a time when I was not making that much money on the road. Like in my early 20s, when I first started touring, I was just borrowing money to be out there. I wasn't making any money. I didn't have an income, really, hardly. And I didn't pay attention. I just drank everything in the mini bar. And the next day, the bill that came in was like, in a Swiss francs or something, I think it was like $1,000.
Oh my god!
And I've just pleaded with them, please, please don't make me pay this.
And what did they do? They let you off the hook?
They tried, yeah. They did whatever they did something, and they were like, well, you can pay it in pieces or something like that.
Wow.
I was like, I can't. How do you leave a hotel without paying the, Yeah, well, that's I don't know if you care to talk about this, but one of the first lessons I ever got on the road was don't ever skimp on food, Always spend your money on food. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
I mean, it really had to rethink that whole thing. Because if you're going out to eat and you think, well, man, I got to be healthy, so I got to have like a real meal. And so it's not every day that you can have a real meal, obviously. Like a home-cooked meal is the best, right? Anyway.
We've had some great meals out with you. I remember,
yeah.
I mean, man, you must have had that dialed in then by the time I got there. Because, shit, I don't remember
so
ever
funny.
Not you'd saying, and
no,
sometimes
I had
you won't have it. I'm going, no, we had four
yeah.
or five course Italian dinners. I remember
that stuff. Yeah.
Some of the most amazing meals with on your tours, actually.
It's gotten leaner, and I think it has to do with the way the music business has changed, Records don't account for sales unless, how about you just did that record, you just won a Grammy, I think.
Oh, that
was it last year or 2 years ago?
That was 2-3 years ago now, yeah.
But was that affected by sales, or did it affect sales at all?
Maybe in a minuscule amount. I mean, it's not, like you said, people don't buy music anymore. They can get it for free, I mean, it's like I've talked about this on the podcast before. There are mm-hmm. generations now coming up where they just assume music is free. It's like, why would I pay for it? It's on YouTube. I can get everything from YouTube. So,
I mean, the truth is that I never had the money to buy records until I was making records, or to go to concerts. I could never afford to go to a concert until I was playing jazz festivals and I could go watch
right.
somebody play. And the truth is that because of that, those mixtapes were like my lifeline, give me a copy of a record that you bought.
Right.
And of course I would buy a record if I could, if I had the money, I would buy a record, but it was few and far between. So I've always tried to figure out, if you really don't have money, isn't it great that you can go on YouTube and get great content?
It is great. And I grew up in that same culture where we make tapes and give it. But the thing is now is, you put out a record. I put out my little solo record, and somebody puts it on a torrent. That's the difference. And the whole world can download it in a minute. That's
right.
A little different than giving your buddy a mixtape of something, It's come on. Yeah, maybe the general idea in a broad sense is the same, but it's not, because now you've got anybody in the world can take it, steal it. It's just stealing,
Mm-hmm.
So I see both sides.
Wow, stealing is what it is.
Yeah. But that's the world we live in now, And people, it's an iPhone culture, man. Everything is
Yeah.
I mean, and it is, like you said, it is amazing too, because I use the technology. Absolutely. We're using it right now. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a double-edged thing. You ever read The Onion? You know what I'm talking about, The Onion?
I love the paper.
There was one, there was one where, because, you're standing, you play in front of a crowd, man. It's like every other person has an iPhone filming it. And somebody did an article where it said, man forced to watch concert after iPhone runs out of power. Man forced to watch concert with own eyes after cell phone runs out of power. And he goes, it was amazing. It was like I could really enjoy it. And
oh, how sweet. I love The Onion. Was realizing recently that I need to find a way to be like that again, so that I'm not writing emails.
Aren't you playing music all the time? Oh, you mean like
like all day long.
Secretarial duties and all the things you have
yeah.
to do. Interviews, fan mail and all that stuff. Emails. Comes along with it, I guess. It's part of the deal.
Well, even just having a bank account is a more of a bohemian kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the allure of a lot of people, I think, nowadays, too, with the whole minimalism thing. And a lot of people come to New Orleans because they think it's bohemian. And I think, in theory, it's a nice romantic idea, but the practical aspects of it is like, it's hard to exist without a bank account.
Yeah, it's hard. Doesn't matter where you are. I mean, you have to create your whole. If you're going to do that, you have to create the whole thing yourself. Yeah. You really have to figure out your own way of doing it.
What did we do without before cell phone? How'd you go on tour without a cell phone?
Yeah.
Or Skype.
Well, remember, you'd have to stop and go to a payphone. But I think it also meant I had more time with my guitar. I had more time with dreams. Dreaming is cool. If you're not always always don't have a screen in front of your eyes and stuff. But
you don't have people texting you all the time. And
ding.
Asking you, can I go over and interview you?
That was so nice, Shane. I love your podcast, and
thank you.
I hope we did a good one today. So
we have more than enough. I'll find some nuggets and.
Awesome, and I hope the music sounds good in the end, because I'm sure I was doing it too slow. If Jeremy had been here, he would have
seen exactly.
Told me it's exactly the wrong
it's supposed
tempo.
To be. No, I love Jeremy. So, anyway, I guess that's it.
Okay.
All right, but actually, we weren't done. We talked and talked and talked for many more hours and actually hung out and had a nice dinner in Chinatown. Love, Maddie. Great to catch up. Hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And I have a lot of other good ones coming up. Let's see. I just finished an interview with my bro, Tommy Malone from the Subdudes, New Orleans. You'll love that one. Lots of laughs. I have one coming up with Adam Levy, who I've known for years. Former Norah Jones guitar player. Does his own thing. Great cat. Lots of other people coming up. Stay tuned. Thanks for helping me spread the word. See you next time on the Riff Raff.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.